So we've been studying the Wisdom series in the Bible, a book, a selection of books that teach us how to live life. I don't know if anyone can agree with me that I felt like this time has changed the way I view some things and even the way I accept responsibility for certain things and understand that I need to be making the right decisions. So even when we delve into the Old Testament, it seems so far removed from the gospel and from Jesus and the things that we know so well as Christians, there's still life-changing truth waiting there to be revealed and to be pulled out and applied to our lives. So Proverbs taught us that if we live a certain way, that if we do what's right, that then we will be rewarded with a good life, that we are promised that the effort we put in to being righteous will result in righteous rewards. And that if we turn to evil, and we turn away from good, that we will be rewarded with evil and deprived of good. And for the most part, that's true. It tells you that is the likely outcome. Then in Ecclesiastes, we heard someone with a different perspective that said, I've lived life and I've observed life. I'm very wise, and here's what I see. Things don't quite work out that way. I know a lot of good people who've suffered and not been rewarded for their righteousness. I know a lot of evil people who've gotten good things and been rewarded and died peacefully, wealthily, happily. And I think maybe Solomon could even say, I also know that I'm not that good, but I have this kingdom, and I have everything that I've ever desired. So both of these books, I think, come together and intersect in the book of Job, where it all comes to a head. Are good people rewarded for doing good things? Are bad people rewarded for doing bad things? How does this all actually play out in the real world? In the physical world, at least. But I think before we even really get into the book of Job, I want to step aside for just a little bit because I was thinking, there's really an incredible philosophical thing happening in the book of Job that is deeper and more impactful to every person's existence in the world than almost anything else philosophers discuss. It's really been the core of many questions. But it's also interesting because it's been often used as a weapon against people of faith. You've all experienced either reading, watching, comments from people who aren't believers, or even personally being confronted with the question that we all know, well, why do bad things happen to good people? Why do good things happen to bad people? Why do bad things happen at all? And it's pointed as an accusation, why does your God allow these things to happen? The interesting little caveat to that accusation is that only someone who believes in an all-powerful creator God and who also believes that he's good would ever have to confront this question. If you do not believe that God is all-powerful or that he created the universe, then this is a meaningless question. There's no reason to confront it. Of course, everything's whatever it is and however it got there. If you believe there's an all-powerful God, but he's not good, or that he's not involved, or that there are multiple gods competing in the universe, of course, then these things would happen. My God happened to be stronger than your God today. The chaos of the world is just the chaos of the world. That's why I'm fighting for what I can get. The only people who have to grapple with this question are people who believe in a good God who created and maintains power over the universe. It requires intellectual honesty and boldness to even confront the question. And that's why it's often used as an accusation. Well, how can your God allow this? There's really no basis to argue it from someone who doesn't believe. And I kind of wonder, you know, when you're confronted with that question, we see the two kingdoms, the two ways of life. And it's presented in Proverbs. We see that we can live in this world, believing that things are chaos and violent and there's no hope for anything, and I'm just fighting and grappling for survival, or we can believe that there is a God who will make things right and will give us life and peace. And so as a believer, we probably ask, why in the world would you choose to live over here when you could step into this kingdom? And I think the root of that is fear. The unwillingness to confront the question is based in fear. And I think we see it a lot of times in the world that as people, we would rather live in a tiny, dark, blood-soaked kingdom that we control than live in a vast, beautiful, peaceful kingdom where we have to obey. And the acceptance of entry into that peaceful kingdom also requires something that I think people are unwilling to give up. Entry into the kingdom of God requires that you die to yourself, to accept a new life. And that's maybe a barrier that's too tall and too hard for the people who want to point and say, how would your God allow this? And so I feel like we can express sympathy for people with that position, with those questions, and understand that they're fighting and they're struggling and they're in a place of fear. But if necessary, I also feel like I can boldly ask in return to someone who is ruler and God of their own kingdom, why do you allow it? Why are you permitting it to happen? We either accept that God created the world and that he is in control, or we have to live in a place of chaos and uncertainty. And that's a little bit at the core of the book of Job. So as believers, we do not have to shy away from the hard questions. We do not have to fear the intellectual effort and strength required to approach these things. We can approach the greatest problems that civilization has ever faced without cowering from the truth. Because we know that in facing those hard questions with the Word and the Spirit, we can step right up to the edge of the universe and marvel at what God has done, about what he has made, and who he is. Even if that marvel is wrapped in mystery and an inability to understand. G.K. Chesterton, when studying the book of Job, I believe he said, the riddles of God are more satisfying than the solutions of man. Wow. It's fitting that we don't have many details about the book of Job, and that many parts of it are left without explanation. We don't know who wrote the book. It's probably one of the oldest books written, and that's been retained as part of the Old Testament. We don't know exactly where Uz is, where Job lived. Maybe it's east or southeast of Palestine. It seems like it's far enough away, the style of storytelling, that it's far enough away from the readers and the author of the book that it means a far, far away land in a time that you don't remember. It may have been on the edge of the Arabian Desert from some of the clues that we hear in the story. And even approaching the book of Job presents questions. Is it a parable? Is it a story that God moved someone to write to help explain in the way Jesus taught us through story how this all works and who God is, to reveal himself? Or is it a literal historical record that this is Job, this is a man who really did live, and you'll get to see him whenever we're with Christ? We don't really know for certain. Either way, the power of the story was given by God to move our hearts and for him to reveal to us exactly what he doesn't want to reveal to us. So Job was a great man. He was a good man. He was the best man, really. In his land of Uz, we'll say somewhere on the edge of the Arabian Desert, he lived as a ruler, as of a vast domain of land and property and people and life. But he didn't get it through power and violence and thievery and deception. He was blameless and he was upright. He was someone who feared God and turned away from evil. Now, it's important that we know the author tells us this. The author didn't tell Job this, but he tells us. And it's important to note that in the second part of the story here, we hear God himself say this, but at no time does God tell Job this. So it's important to understand where his pain's coming from as we experience the story. And it's important for us to understand God affirms that he was blameless. He was upright, and he turned away from evil. You might remember the verse in Proverbs 16:6-7 that we read when we studied Proverbs. By steadfast love and faithfulness, iniquity was atoned for, and by the fear of the Lord, one turns away from evil. And I thought this next verse is interesting. It might give us a clue to Job's success at this point. When a man's ways please the Lord, he makes even his enemies to be at peace with him. And Job probably didn't know the Proverbs and didn't know that verse, but I think that he knew that truth. Because of the way he dealt with people, because of the way he governed his little realm, his vast realm at the time, people were at peace with him. People came to do trade. People came to do business. He provided for so many people.
Because he feared the Lord, he said.
He feared the Lord and turned away from evil. His property was a full self-sustaining property. In the swaths of land that he had 7,000 sheep, which is a vast number. With those sheep, he had a whole operation to provide clothing and food for the people under his care and for his family, to build trade and develop the towns and establish part of this little space, a world of peace and prosperity. Sitting against the edge of the desert like they were, farmers and nomads coexisted in this place. It was a place of desert on the one hand, but fertility and growth on the other. A place of lawless violence and injustice in one place, but a place of peace and wealth on the other. He was so wealthy, later in verse 10, the word that's used in Hebrew actually means broken out or flooded. He was growing so much that his domain was going to expand and swallow up everything around it for good. He also had 3,000 camels and all of the attendant camel herders and trainers and husbandrymen to take care of them. These camels represent trade and travel for his enterprise. He could move the wealth that he had to other places and return the things that he needed. Maybe it was fabrics and spice or herbs. And he could project his influence into the regions around so that he could continue to develop more and more chaos into order, more death into life. But that wasn't all. He had 500 pairs, I believe yoke means, of oxen, and 500 female donkeys. So he could run his farming operation with an incredibly high efficiency. These oxen could plow the fields. They could also provide meat and sacrifice. These donkeys could be used to tend the land and grow and to move equipment and people around. They provided farming for and sustaining food that didn't spoil as quickly. And of course, he could load them onto his camels and sell them to other towns and regions. It says that he was really the greatest in the East. Of all of the people who had land holdings and properties and enterprises, he was the guy. He was Job. If you needed something, you could say, maybe I'll travel to Job. I'll go talk to his men. I'll go buy some of his animals. I know he won't cheat me, and I know it will be great. Now, he also had 7 sons and 3 daughters. For someone who looked ahead to the future, for someone who believed God's vision of restoring a world of order and life and peace, these children were critical. He took personal joy and delight in them. He loved them dearly, but he also saw the value in the kingdom of God, that those sons would build houses and families and would expand to generations beyond him, that his daughters would be like missionaries and would become members of another family's household and help spread that peace and that life and that uprightness into other communities. As he stood at the top of his little kingdom and looked over it, he saw that it was good, and he was grateful for it. His sons and daughters were so close, his family connection remained so strong, that even though those sons had their own houses, they would meet sometimes every day of the week at a different son's house to host a feast and to celebrate and fellowship with each other. Job had a practice that every day, says in the morning, to tell us, a way of telling us that he was faithful and diligent. He got up and made sacrifice and pleaded to God to forgive any sins that he may have overlooked and any sins that his children may have committed that they weren't aware of. He was doing the work of a priest and ensuring that his family was represented to God and that God was represented to them. It seems that he was performing this task with greater diligence than so many of the priests of the temple ever did. Job was a good man. I don't know that I can ever be like Job. But he was rewarded, it seems, in Job's estimation, for this, because of his vast wealth. But as he stood looking over his kingdom, if we could be pulled violently and startlingly through the realms and land in the heavenly realm, the sons of God or the heavenly creatures are meeting in God's council chamber. We've talked before about how God chooses to work in the spiritual realm just like he does in the physical realm through beings he's created and assigned tasks and responsibilities. And in Job, it tells us there's a day when they all come together to present themselves before God, almost like an assembly to report what they've been doing. And so in this great throne, which we've caught glimpses of in Zechariah's visions and Ezekiel's visions and Daniel's visions, we see God sitting at his throne and a host of powerful spiritual beings coming to worship or to present and report the tasks they've been assigned. One steps up to the front through the crowd, pushes his way in. The Bible uses the term Satan or Satan. It's not entirely clear. That term means accuser or adversary. So we don't really know for sure if it's someone who's playing the role in this case or if it's the person or the character or creature we know that fell from grace and that rebelled against God and we hear so much about in the New Testament. It seems like it may be that case because of how he answers later. I'll mention that in a moment. But as he steps up, God recognizes Satan and says, "From where have you come?" In verse 7, it says, "Satan answered the Lord and said, 'From going to and fro in the earth and from walking up and down it.'" And in 1 Peter 5, 7 and 8, we're told to be sober-minded, be watchful. "Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour. Resist him, firm in your faith, knowing that the same kinds of suffering are being experienced by your brotherhood throughout the world." That term, prowling around the world, kind of feels a little similar to going to and fro. Ephesians 6:12 also reminds us that we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers of this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. So very well could be his domain. It's where he was sent. Now, God's response when he looks up and says, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there's none like him on earth?" And here's where God affirms the author, "a blameless and upright man who fears me and turns away from evil." This is interesting that at this moment, that's the first thing God says. Of course, God reads his heart. Of course, God knows what lies inside of all of his creatures. But it does almost seem that there's been an ongoing conversation, a relationship that's just being picked up in the middle here. Are we seeing those early phases of Satan's rebellion against God, his disagreement with how the universe is ruled, which is a corollary a little bit to Job's challenge later, Job's challenging God and how he rules the universe. But in this case, this person never repents or accepts. It seems that Satan has maybe previously accused mankind and perhaps God of not being right. God calls up Job as a testimony. "Have you considered the greatest man? There's none like him in all the earth." Now, it could be Satan has already fallen at this point. Maybe he's prowling around, devouring. And he laments Job's uprightness and the influence he's having on changing the world around him into, at that time, a modern-day Eden. It could be that his disorder and chaos and violence was being consumed by life and order and peace, and Satan just knows that he has to find a way to get to him. Now, in the same way that Satan's seeming victory over Christ resulted in his ultimate defeat, Job's upcoming loss, grief, and confrontation with God actually ends up resulting in an even larger realm of order and peace that was ruled by Job. So after God offers up Job as an example, Satan inverts the question that we've asked before, why do bad things happen to good people? And he asks God, essentially, why do good things happen to good people? Of course your servants are going to follow you. Of course Job is going to worship you and get up every morning and do sacrifices and long to do what you want him to do, because you've built a wall around his kingdom. He's living in a fort. Nothing can touch him. He's just doing it for his own good. But if you reached out and you took away those things, if you knock down that wall, he'll curse you to your face. Now, why would God even tolerate Satan being in this council chamber? Why would he tolerate this accusation? And why would he answer in the way he's about to answer Job, or answer Satan regarding Job? Well, you don't get to know. We're looking in a council with a ruler that's mysterious and vast. And as Job learns later, there's just no way you can judge his decisions. There's no way you can render an opinion on his judgments. God says, behold, all that he has is in your hand. Only against him do not stretch out your hand. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. So we return back to the kingdom. The feast days have ended. Job's family are headed back, getting ready to head back to their own homes. Job got up early in the morning and walked up to the hilltop where he does his sacrifices. He prayed to God and interceded on behalf of his children, offering an extra sacrifice, pleading to God to take care of his family, to take care of his servants, to take care of his people, and to make sure that they all corrected any sins that they had in their own hearts. As he stood there, he saw someone come running up the hill, through his houses, and approach him. Job, I have something to tell you. And he relayed a story. The oxen were plowing out in the fields, getting ready for planting. The donkeys were feeding the pastures beside them. And the Sabaeans fell upon them and took all of them and killed the servants with the edge of the sword. I was going to get water for the donkeys, and I was just coming back. I am lucky to be alive, but everything and everyone else is gone. As Job looked to the east, towards his farmlands, he saw his food, his provision. He saw the wall around that part of his kingdom start to crumble. While he's catching his breath and steadying the shoulder of his servant who barely escaped with his life, another voice comes shouting up behind him, Job! 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 As Job turns with the servant from the farmlands, he sees one of his servants from the sheep herders and from the pastures. Job, Job! We were out in the fields. I had just stepped away. I was chasing a wild dog away from the sheep, and I heard a noise, and I turned, and I came back. The sky was red, and there was smoke, and there was clouds. I can't even really explain what happened, but it was hot, and it burned my throat. The sheep are all gone. The servants are all gone. I barely made it out alive, but everything and everyone is gone. As Job turned and looked to the south where his pastures were, he could still see clouds drifting away. And he saw his servants, his family, his people without new clothes. He saw them without the mutton and the sheep to eat. He saw that wall start to crumble. As he held onto the shoulders of both of his servants who were in shock, barely surviving a horrible event, he starts to bow his head as he hears another person shouting, Listen, Job, master, I was out with the camels. We were moving them from one pasture land to another, preparing for a caravan. The Chaldeans, he can barely speak the words as he's shouting and stumbling, but they came in from all sides. They took the camels. The camels, they're gone. There are no camels. And this, the... I wasn't there. I was late getting out to the field this morning, and they're all gone. I'm alive, but everything else and everyone else is dead. They're gone. Job looks over to the west, where his camels had been stationed. He can't see as far as they were because his land was so vast, but he can imagine those fields, he can imagine those hills, and he sees the trade, the influence, and even the protection that he's able to provide through his men on the camels. And he sees that wall start to crumble. And he's just about to sit down. He's just about to sit down and ponder how to solve the problem, what to do, how to restore his kingdom, when someone comes running up the hill in front of him. They're not yelling. They're afraid to even confront Job until he has to say, tell me, what's happening? Job, I can't tell you. Job, it's the last feast day. Your family, your sons and daughters, they were all at your oldest son. I know. What happened? Tell me what happened. The wind from the desert, that hot wind, it blew. There was a storm. I don't know. It just blew. His house came down. What? Are they okay? No. I'm the only one who was able to get out. I'm okay. But everyone else and everything else is gone. At that moment, Job stood back up. He tore his outer robe and fell to the ground. And he worshiped the Creator, God. And he said in verse 21, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." The author tells us at this moment, Job did not sin. He did not charge God with wrong. He didn't say anything bad about God. So we're pulled back through the heavens into another realm. It's another day where the heavenly beings, the heavenly council is called to present to God. Satan again was among them and stepped up. God said, "Where have you been?" Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth and from walking up and down on it." And the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there's none like him on earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil? He still holds fast his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without reason." Satan answered the Lord and said, "Skin for skin, all that a man has he will give for his life. But if you stretch out your hand, touch his bone and his flesh, then he'll curse you to your face." God looked at this member of the heavenly council and said, "Behold, he is in your hand. Only spare his life." Now, the word that God used in this account to say spare his life really means to create a hedge. In this moment, even, God is telling Satan, "You have to keep him alive. It's now your responsibility to make sure he doesn't die." So even the enemy, who's just desperate to hurt Job, is now actually tasked with protecting his life, even as he harms him and tries to undermine Job's integrity. So we don't know how many days or weeks later, but Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and struck Job with loathsome sores from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. It was so bad that he had to take pieces of broken pottery with sharp edges to try to scrape the boils and the wounds. He could get no relief as he sat in his ashes and mourning with his shaved head, looking over his empty fields and his houses. It felt like the final wall had come down. Now he couldn't solve the problems He couldn't rebuild his kingdom. He couldn't even grieve for his children because every moment was a physical agony. All he could think about was how to find relief for his flesh. So he's sitting on the hill alone with God, not knowing what to do, not knowing where to go. So he turns back down over the hill to his last earthly comfort, his wife, who we must remember is suffering the same tremendous loss and wounds that Job is facing. But it seems that maybe she wasn't prepared to face it the way he was. As he turned to her, she said, "Job, why are you still following God? Why are you still up here in the morning to try to do a sacrifice? You can't even lift your hands without weeping and pain. Just curse God and die, and you'll be free." But he rebuked her and said, "You're speaking like one of the foolish women." He knew that that wasn't her. He said, "Should we receive good from God and not also receive evil?" And again, in this moment, Job did not sin with his lips. It seems that Job's spirit of sacrifice and his daily practice of humility and worship had protected him from sinning at that moment of impact. Although the hard questions and painful struggle would still have to be dealt with, he had prepared in peaceful times for the times of upheaval. So we join him as he's sitting here alone. His wife has gone back down over the hill. Darkness is coming across. Unlike the days past, he doesn't see the lamps lighting up in the tents and the houses in his domain. He doesn't see the fires being lit on the hillsides and the pastures. He just sees darkness rolling in as the sun sets. He's not sure of anything at this point. When we find ourselves at that place, we have to be prepared to respond as Job did. At that moment, to not sin against God, but be willing then to step into the authenticity and boldness that he has to ask God, to challenge God, and demand answers from God. In Philippians 2, 12 and 13, we're told, "My beloved, as you have always obeyed, so now, not only is in my presence, but much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. For it is God who works in you, both to will and to work for his good pleasure." So as darkness fell, Job could hear his wife weeping in the tent, mourning behind him. He looked through his swollen, painful eyes as the gray dust gathered around him. His kingdom had fallen. He had nothing left. He'd examined his heart, and he could find no sin that deserved this punishment. He just didn't understand. He could see some dark shapes in the distance, by the empty sheep pastures, the silhouette of three men approaching. And he bowed his head, bloody tears flowing down his swollen, disfigured face. At this moment, Job was about to begin the painful, exhausting, and necessary work of finding out who he was and who God is.